Flashman and the Angel of the Lord by George MacDonald Fraser. Continued. Cassette 4, side 2.
And again, and for the last time, he came with his blandest fat smile, don't ever think you can jump off the wagon wrong the way. The cuckoos will be there, always. And if you play false by word or deed, then, sir, you are crow pickings.
He rose, smoothing his coat and shooting his cuffs, and stowed his writings in his pocket.
I believe that is all, so I confide you to Dea, Annette. And Joe, of course, and your unseen guardians. Your servant, ma'am. Honored to have made your acquaintance, sir. I bid you adieu and good fortune. And you take care now, you hear?
You know, when I look back on those bizarre few hours when the Ku Klux took me by the neck and twisted me to their crazy ends, the rummest thing of all wasn't the amazing coincidence of Annette, or those grotesque hoods, or that obese monster so pathetically bang up to the nines, or even that incredible plot. But those last six words from Atropos, after all the threats and blackmail, the gentle ritual of the Dixie farewell. God help me, I believe he meant it. When he'd gone, it occurred to me to twit Annette that she had an admirer in our dandy hippo. I asked innocently if he was her lover, expecting a fine explosion, and was taken flat aback by her reply.
He's my husband.
Good God, he can't be. What, that great big bag of jelly? What happened to Mandeville?
He died.
And you married that? Well, I never. God, what a wedding night that must have been. I let out a yelp of horror. But my God, he knew. Well, he suspected, I'm sure, what we'd been up to. I mean, before he arrived, you know, when we were...
He was already here, in this room, watching us.
Says she, cool as be damned, before the mirror titivating her low-cut bodice.
You will see there's a spy hole in the door at the bedroom.
You don't mean it, but... I had a terrifying memory of lying helpless beneath his sword stick, and he just watched me rattling his wife. God almighty, but you mean he don't mind?
On the contrary.
She patted her hair.
He insists.
Well, strike me dead. I say, he must be a damn rum chap. You, but you, I mean, why the devil?
Do I do it, you would ask?
She took a last sneer at the mirror and faced me.
He is the richest man in Louisiana. He's also the brain, though not the head, of the Ku Klux. You've been singularly honored by his personal attention, a measure of your importance.
She gave me a withering look up and down.
You probably think him mad. He's not. Whatever he plans, succeeds. And whatever he promises, he performs. Remember that for your own sake. Now it's past 5 o'clock, and I wish to dine before we leave.
She drew herself up like a tiny guardsman.
Give me your arm, and take me down.
So I did, ruminating on the manners and morals of the old South. And now that we'd broken the ice so splendidly, we were soon chatting away in the dining room like an old married couple, as I described at the beginning of this chapter. I affected a carelessness I was far from feeling, because I wanted to test just how real were the threats that Atropos had made. Her alarm told me all I wanted to know, and gave me some useful information. Apart from Joe, who was lurking in the lobby while we ate, there were two cook-cloth shadows watching me, and no doubt they or others would be on hand all the way to New York. I'd have to look damn slippy when the time came to run. It was a mad pickle, you may think, held prisoner amidst all the bustle and confusion of civilized society. But if your captors know their business and are ruthless enough, why, you might as well be chained in a dungeon. Rudi von Starnberg took me halfway across Germany against my will, simply by having a gun and a knife and being ready to use them if I so much as sneezed out of turn. And I'd no doubt the cook class would be equally unscrupulous. So I could only wait and seem to play up, both of which I'm good at, and take comfort in the knowledge that they'd not harm me unless forced to, since I was no use to them, dead or bound for Kentucky. Being resigned, I felt easier, and even a touch light-headed, as we cowards will when we feel safe for the moment. The upshot was that, with bottle and belly timber before him, Flashy became, if not beastly, at least mischievously drunk, enjoying himself and contemplating the charms of the choice little icicle across the table. I'd already noted that she'd put some elegant flesh on her elfin form over the years, and was altogether a juicier morsel than she'd been in Greystones. She might still wear the expression of an ill-tempered ferret, But that kind of viciousness on a handsome face has its own attraction. And I knew perfectly well that her artistic paintwork and stylishly coiled blonde hair had been designed for my benefit. She'd always loathed and lusted after me together, which only added spice to her allurement. And I looked forward as much as she did to the enjoyment of Mr. Comer's marital rights. On this happy thought, I was content to idle my way through the dinner, which, like all American meals, was gargantuan and over-rich. How the devil he can put away a massive breakfast of steak, ham, eggs, terrapin, or giant oysters, two dinners at noon and five, and still be fit to beat their bellies at supper is beyond me. Even Annette, who wasn't two pisspots and a handle high, worked her way through five courses without breaking sweat on her pale, immaculate brow. Unlike most of her compatriots, she didn't shout through her food, so I had leisure to listen to the deafening chatter around us. From the trumpetings of two portly, curry-faced gentry at the next table, I gathered that President Buchanan was a weak-kneed nincompoop for not going ahead and teaching them damned impotent greases a lesson by annexing half their country. War with Mexico would, in the Speaker's opinion, rally the public behind Old Buck, ensure a Democratic victory in next year's election, and be one in the eye for that slippery bastard Seward and his damned black Republicans.
"I hear Seward's gone to England,"
says his companion. "Best place for the negro-loving son of a bitch. I hope his vessel sinks. I mean it, sir, I do. Can you imagine President Seward? That's what'll come to yet, you mark my words."
"Come now, sir, he may not get nominated even."
"You want a wager, sir? Why, he's got weed and Greeley in his pocket. What's that you say, Tilda? Give you ladies the vote and it'll beat President Douglas. Why, he ain't but a damn dwarf. You'd like to cuddle him, you say. You hear that, Ambrose? Tilda thinks Douglas is right cuddlesome. Well, now, honey, I reckon his beauteous Adele might have something to say about that." "I just reckon she might, and so might yours truly. You keep your cuddles for Papa, you hear?" And the lecherous old goat laid a fond paw on the arm of the languid Tilda, who might have been his wife, but I think not, from the wanton freedom with which she had been glancing in my direction.
"I declare Tilda would put Adele right in the shade," cries the other roué gallantly. "Never seen her in such looks. How you do that, Tilda? All the soirees and parties, you ought to be clean wild. But darn, if you don't come up fresh and dew on a lily. You got some magic potion, sweetheart?"
"Know what she's got," cries her escort. "She got this electric rejuvenation contraption, and a colored wench to mechanic it. Why, they all the crack with the smart gals, ain't they, Tilda? Puts the blue mop back in those damaged cheeks in no time at all. And all over, too." "Yes, sir, that's my honey's secret."
"Why, you make me sound like some kind of monster works on electricity,"
drawls the fair Tilda, luring her lashes at me and showing her profile.
"But my machine is right stimulating." "Our train leaves in an hour,"
says Annette sharply.
"You will wait in the lobby while Joe fetches a carriage, and keep your tongue and eyes to yourself, do you hear?"
Her mouth was tight with anger, and there was a little flush on her cheek.
"Do nothing to excite attention."
"Difficult, when we're such a handsome couple," says I, leering. "We want to pass unnoticed. Why the deuce are we parading before half Washington? Suppose one of Crix's people is about."
"You know them all by sight, and they will not be seeking you here or at the station. Joe has seen to it. Stop guzzling that wine, you fool. Now, follow me out closely."
What with the booze, my natural taste for devilment, and confidence that I was perfectly safe as long as I didn't try to run for it, I felt a sudden urge to put turpentine on her dainty little tail and light it. So, when I'd drawn back her chair and she'd made for the lobby without a glance at me, I navigated carefully in her wake, turned in the doorway, surveyed the glittering splendour of the dining room and its chattering gluttons, drew a deep breath and let out a Lakota war whoop at the top of my voice. A woman shrieked. Men sprang to their feet. A passing waiter went up like a galvanized grouse and dropped his loaded tray with a tremendous smash. And then there was dead silence as 100 mouths gaped and 200 eyes goggled. Every head turned, in fact, save for a tall chap near the door who kept his eyes fixed on his plate, and another with his back turned who watched me like a hawk in a mirror on the far wall. I strolled into the lobby where Annette was standing rigid with fury. People were craning towards the dining room to see what the row was.
"Are you mad?"
she hissed. "You're right," says I. "The boys are in there. But the cockroaches ought to train them better, you know. It ain't natural not to stare when a lunatic cuts loose in public. Now then, where's that dilatory Joe with the carriage, eh? Her eyes were blazing, but she swept off without a word, leaving me to look about and wonder which of the throng in the lobby might be Kuklos' shadows. But Joe had disappeared, and the two betrayed by my little ruse in the dining room hadn't emerged. But I wasn't fool enough to imagine that I wasn't being watched. I gave up, though, for the patrons of Washington hotels in those days were such a mixed lot. My unseen watchers might have been anyone. There were the obvious politicos standing about in knots, puffing their cigars and disputing warmly. Wealthy citizens with stout matrons dressed up like May Day cuddies. Young blades in fancy waistcoats and amazing whiskers. With fashionable bells gushing and squealing on their arms. Plantation aristocrats in their broad-brimmed straws with little nigger boys toting their bags. Likely-looking fellows in city clothes, but with the unmistakable silence of the frontier hanging round them like a shroud. Barefoot slaves waiting patiently beyond the great doors leading to the marble porch. Thin, seedy fellows with ferret eyes questing for senator this or congressman that, and muttering to each other before scurrying away like the political rodents they were. One or two top-drawer strumpets, immediately recognizable by being the most tastefully dressed women in view. And everywhere the great curse of the New World. The American child, in all its raucous, spoiled, undisciplined, selfish ghastliness. The female specimens keeping up an incessant high-pitched whine. And the male infants racketing like cowpokes on payday. There's nothing wrong with grown Americans, by and large. You won't find heartier men or bonnier women anywhere. But the only remedy I can see for their children is to run Herod for president. Then Joe was at my elbow with a slouch hat and a long coat, guiding me out of the throng and down a passage to the same side door by which I'd entered the hotel, where a growler was waiting with Annette inside, raging silently. She said not a word as we bowled through the dust to the station. And when we drew up close by the train, they had platforms in those days, she whisked out and into the carriage while Joe signed to me to sit tight. He descended, spying both ways before beckoning abruptly, and I strode quickly through the wreathing steam with the bell clanging overhead and mounted into the sudden quiet of the train. I wasn't well acquainted with American railroads at that time and was resigned to an uncomfortable long haul through the night to New York. In one of those reeking long coaches in which I travelled down from Baltimore, full of noisy, unwashed louts whose favourite occupation was spitting at the stove. But no such thing. Here was a quiet corridor with private compartments, which they called cabins, fitted up in tip-top style. Annette was in number 8, I remember. I had a glimpse of an alcove bed with curtains drawn back, a washstand and comfortable furniture. And then Joe was hustling me into number 7, which seemed smaller, but had a bed beneath the window. I asked him where he was going to sleep, and he replied curtly that he wasn't. I made myself comfortable while he slipped out, and presently I heard his deep rumble in Annette's cabin, and the conductor saying anything she wanted, ma'am, anything at all, she should just send her boy, and would be attended to right smartly. Then Joe returned, sitting on the floor with his back against the door, and a moment later the bell clanged and the steam whistled, and the conductor bawled that this was the night to fly to Baltimore, Wilmington, Philadelphia, Trenton, and New York. And we jolted and clanked into motion, and I reflected that my evasion would have to wait until journey's end. I didn't fancy dropping from a moving train, even if Joe hadn't been on hand. He was a big, ugly Gaia scooter, that one, his sleeves tight on his enormous biceps, as he sat with his arms folded on his barrel chest, the yellow-flecked eyes rolling at me whenever I stirred on the bed. I found myself studying him. He was your real jet-black Nubian, flat-nosed, thick-lipped, and could have walked into the KAR nowadays, the King's African Rifles, no questions asked. Having nothing better to do for the moment, I indulged my idle curiosity. Joe, says I, why are you with the Kuklos? He glowered suspiciously. What do you mean? Well, you're Atropos's slave, yet you've been with Crixus on the railroad, had the chance to escape to free soil. Why didn't you? You want to be free, surely? He studied me in turn, the black face expressionist. Then, you got niggers in England, that's all. Yes, a few, and they're all free, so are the niggers in our empire in Africa and the West Indies. No one owns them or can make them do what they don't like or sell them down the river. Wouldn't you like that? He sat, apparently thinking, though you couldn't be sure with that face. At last he said, "You English niggers, how many on them got a fine coat like this here?" He ran a finger the size of a truncheon down his lapel. "How many on them got a silver timepiece and chain? How many got $5 in their pocket?" "Why, Joe, you could have all those things in Canada, say, and be free into the bargain. You could do whatever you liked. Go wherever you liked, be your own master." He digested this, staring at the floor, and shrugged his huge shoulders. "I guess so," says he slowly, "and I could be tread like black trash whenever I liked, and get out the way, nigger, whenever I liked, and go hungry whenever I liked, and beg my bread and go to jail whenever I liked." He raised his bullet head and stared at me. It was like looking into the eyes of an ape in a cage. "Don't have none of that with Master Charles. I's slave, but they treat me like a man, and folks respects me because I's his nigger. Don't get tread like no black trash, no sir. Get good victuals, get good clothes like this here." He closed his eyes and gave a great growling sigh. "And I gets to hump his little white lady whenever Master Charles says so. Oh, but she is prime white meat. None of your free niggers gets that kind of pleasure, and I reckon." I was shocked. Not that I'm a prude, you understand, but because I knew the physical loathing that Annette had for black skin. Why, at Greystones, any wench who'd had the misfortune to touch her by accident hadn't been able to walk for a week. The thought of her with this human gorilla... Well, my little French aristo was paying a price for being the richest woman in Louisiana, wasn't she just? You ask your African niggers where they'd rather be free. "Or Joe," growls he, showing his gleaming teeth in a great wolfish grin. "See what they tell you." "Ah, but they don't any better, Joe, you do. They're savages, but you're, well, civilized. I mean, I've seen how you carry yourself with Crixus and with Atropos, too. You're not a common nigger. Well, I bet you can read, can't you?" He stuck out his sullen lip. "Some, writing and figuring, though. They kind of tough." It's not often that you find yourself conversing with a caveman, and I was becoming interested. "But see, if you can read a little, you can learn to write and, figure fast enough. Why, man, you could make something of yourself. And if you were free, you could buy all the white tarts you wanted. Mandeville's nothing special, I can tell you. You're a fool, Joe. But you needn't go on being one, you know. You can be something better than a slave." "I can't be white," growls he, shaking his head. And then he frowned, and a wicked glitter came into his eyes. "See, Mr. Comer, you trying to talk yourself out of this? You trying to fool this poor colored boy?" "No such thing. Why, if I wanted to be out of this, as you call it, don't think that you could stop me. I'm here because I'm being paid. Ah, there you have it. I'm free, you see, but you're not, because you're content to be bound to that great fat slug when you could be..." And then I caught the gleam in his eyes, and I stared for a moment, and then lay back on the bed, looking at the ceiling, anger giving way to amusement. "Joe," says I at length, "you're a smart black son of a bitch, aren't you, though?" I began to laugh, and so did he, the great black face split in a melon grin, his shoulders heaving. "Oh, you poor coloured boy, so writing and figuring are tough, are they?" "Sir," chuckles he, "can't hold a pencil in my big black fingers, nohow. Oh, leave off. Begging your bread, forsooth, and mumbling like a field hand. What's the capital of Portugal?" "Let me see. I go to study that. Tin Madrid, no sir. Gay Paris. Lisbon, maybe. Say, though, which you little old English kings got yourself murdered in the Tower of London in 1483? Don't be daft. Oh, very well, which one?" "Edward V. He was just 12 years old, and his mammy was a lady called Elizabeth Woodville." He sat there chortling, the jolly darky to the life, damn him. "Yes, I should have remembered, shouldn't I, that anyone who can spy inside the Underground Railroad and fool Crixus knows more than picking cotton. Went to school along with Atropos, Master Charles, did you?" "Niggers don't attend school. No, we had the same governess and the same nursery. Master Charles' papa was an experimental gentleman, so he raised us the same." He was smiling still, but the black eyes were expressionless. Wanted to see how it came out, I guess.
"But see, this is all the more reason why my question's good, Joe. Why, being raised like that and educated and knowing what you do, why, in God's name, do you stay a slave? Don't you want to be free, for heaven's sake?" Just for a second he avoided my eye, then his chin came up.
Mine's as good too, Comer.
It came out in his harsh bass growl.
I don't need to be free. I serve Master Charles as a friend. His best friend, like I told you. He trusts me, I trust him. The way he goes, I go. He want me to work for the Kuklus, I work for the Kuklus. He want me to keep hold on P.M. Comer and make sure he earned that $5,000.
The smile on the primitive face was a knowing glimmer now, and not pleasant.
I keep a hold, or maybe take a little rise out of him for fun, and so we both know what's what, but that don't signify a bit. You stay held, Comer, all the way, make no mistake about that. So there, Comer. Evidently my question anent slavery had annoyed him, and he was reminding me what was what.
Well, Joe, all I can say is that Master Charles's fortune's in the world of his friend.
That's right.
And tell me, when he says, hump my wife for my entertainment, do you do it as a friend, or as an obedient slave?
I'll swear his eyes glowed, and he wasn't a pretty sight. Then he smiled, and was even less pretty. It ain't no hardship, especially 'cause she don't like it. She don't like it at all. She just can't buy knickers, it seems.
Oh, well, there's no pleasing some people, is there? Happy little menage you must all have together. Fortunately, however, she can abide white men, and I rather think she's expecting me.
I swung my legs off the bed, and he seemed to flow upright like a genie towering out of a bottle. I feigned surprise.
Don't worry, Joe, I shan't run away.
He stood, glaring down at me, undecided, and I wondered if he was going to assert his guardianship. But he had style, did Joe, in his own way, for after a long moment he stood aside, giving me his nastiest grin, and unlatched the door.
So, you go right ahead, like an obedient free white man. You're right welcome to the niggers' leavings. And I know you won't run, because of that $5,000. And this...
He pulled back his coat to show the pistol butt.
You go along now, and enjoy yourself, you hear?
Why, Joe, I believe I surely will,
says I.
Tell you something else, Joe. So will she.
I winked at him.
You think about that.
And she did, so far as I could judge, which was never easy with La Mandeville. Quite the most unsociable mistress I ever mounted. Most women I've known have exchanged seductive pleasantries beforehand, squealed and gasped during performance, and chatted comfortably afterwards. Except my Elspeth, who gasses throughout, bless her.
Not Annette. When I accosted her that night in her cabin, it was grey stones all over again. Cold, clawing passion. And then sullen silence until she fell asleep. However, when the train bell woke her, at Philadelphia, if memory serves, she went to work like Poppea on honeymoon, which I took as a compliment, before assuming her impersonation of a Trappist nun, if there is such a thing. It was at this stage that I succeeded in getting a snatch of conversation out of her, and most interesting it proved to be. In the interval between rounds, so to speak, while she lay cold and quiet beside me in the cramped berth, I'd been reflecting on Joe's capricious behaviour. For a while there, we'd got on rather well. He'd taken me in by playing the darky simpleton, teased me cheerily, and then, all unintended, I'd touched him on the raw, probably by my impatient concern for his enslaved condition. Christ, you can't do right for doing wrong with these folk. So he turned ornery on me, being redoubled and set down, and from that moment we were sworn enemies. Well, the hell with him, at all events in trying to coax some chat out of my tiny paramour after our final gallop, in which she'd drawn blood in two places. I mentioned Joe's name, partly out of curiosity, but mostly out of malice, I confess. And she started like a galvanized frog.
What of him? What did he say?
Uh-huh, thinks I. Guilty conscience. Capital.
Oh, this and that. He's an odd chap. No fool, for all he looks like a backward baboon. Knows more English history than I do, anyway.
What? History, you say?
She was wide awake now.
What does that black beast know about it?
Well, the name of Edward V's mother, for one thing. Quite extraordinary. Aye, a most educated nigger, smart as paint. I'm surprised your husband trusts him.
She was silent a moment.
Why should he not?
Well, Joe's a slave, ain't he? And here he is heading for the Free States. So what's to hinder him lighting out for Canada? I would, if I were he. But when I put it to him, he said your husband was his best friend and he'd not dream of running from him. You know, loyalty, that sort of thing.
Loyalty? What do animals know of loyalty?
Well, I don't know. Dogs are loyal, they say. Oh, I never found them, so my Aunt Paget had one of those damned poodles when I was a kid. Stank. But she swore it was faithful. Took a great lump out of my arse when I tried to stick it onto some hens.
What else did the brute tell you?
Nothing. I yawned. And when she turned away and settled down, I gave a drowsy chuckle. Nothing much, leastways. Oh, yes, I gather Joe likes white women. Unwilling ones for choice. She lay dead still. So still I could sense the sudden tension of her muscles. Good luck to you, Joe, thinks I, if ever Atropos kicks the bucket unexpected and you become the widow's property. I waited for her fury to vent itself in shrieks of rage or fine French oaths, but nothing came for at least a minute, and then the most astonishing thing happened. She turned slowly towards me in the berth, and her hand stole across, searching for mine, and to my amazement she nuzzled her head onto my shoulder. Her tiny body was trembling, and damned if I didn't feel wetness trickling on my skin. She was absolutely weeping, with a soft, murmuring wail that I could hardly hear until it turned into a faint, broken whisper.
Oh, hold me.
I couldn't credit. Annette Mandeville, the spurred succubus, hard as a diamond and vicious with it, whimpering like a lost child. I slipped an arm about her, marveling, and she clung closer still, pushing her blubbering face under my chin.
Oh, hold me, close, oh please.
Well, naked tits never appealed to me in vain, so I drew her over me with her small rump in my one hand. She was the veriest flyweight. She lay there keening away, bedewing my manly bosom with her tears. Baffling, I found it, but rather jolly. I disengaged the clasp of her fingers so that I could work at her poonts with one hand and her stern with the other.
No, not that,
sobbed she.
Only comfort me, oh please, hold me close.
She was crying hard now with a great yearning misery.
Please, comfort me.
So I did, stroking her hair and petting her in a bewildered fashion, asking myself if I'd ever understand women. She clung like a clam, and after a while her weeping subsided into little sniffs and sighs, and I guess she was dropping off to sleep. So then I cheered her up properly. Some cynic once observed that it was impossible to see the sights of New York City because there were no cabs to take you about, but it didn't matter because there were no sights to see anyway. I can't agree. Whether there were cabs or not in 59, I didn't have time to find out, but for sights. Well, there may have been no St. Paul's, or Rialto, or Arc de Triomphe, or mouldering piles of stone, or dreary galleries stuffed with the rubbish of centuries. But there was something far more moving, inspiring, and aesthetically pleasing to the eye than any of these. And you didn't need a cab to see them, either, as they sashayed along Broadway past the old Astor House by the park, resplendent in their silks and satins and furs, with those ridiculous fetching hats and parasols above, and the extravagantly high heels below. I refer to the women of New York, who for beauty of face and form, elegance of dress and general style and deportment, are quite the finest I've struck. Until they open their mouths, that is, which they do most of the time, but even that incessant nasal braying can't rob them of their exquisite charm. I don't mean only the trollops either, of whom there were said to be 2,000 in a population of 750,000 in 59. And who counted them, I can't imagine. Some clergyman, no doubt. But the respectable women of every class. I was enchanted at first sight, and if I were condemned to spend my dotage sitting in Stewart's store or the Metropolitan Lobby, contemplating the passing peaches, I wouldn't mind a bit. Provided I was furnished with earplugs against the cackling laughter and cries of,
"You bat, be blowed," and, "Okay, bow."
But they probably have different cries nowadays, and no powdered hands or Grecian bins, alas. They absolutely ruled the place then. New York was a woman's town, and let no one tell you different. They were the queens of the world, and didn't they know it?
Not that they were pushing, you understand. They were just freer and bolder and more forward and independent than any women I'd seen elsewhere, taking it for granted that men existed to serve and minister to them, and not t'other way about. For example, you could be on an omnibus, going through the inconvenience of paying the driver through his little window, and three or four dolly mops would come on, chattering and laughing behind you, drop their money in your hand, and expect you to pay it over and bring him the change. Perfect strangers, too. Mind you, the reward of a free and easy smile, and thanks, chief, from a pert New Yorker, is a delight. Given time, I'd have been haunting that omnibus yet. Everything was for their convenience, too. Hotels had their ladies' entrances and dining rooms, so that the dears wouldn't be offended by the reek of cigars and the conversation of horrid men. Every other shop seemed to be dedicated to cosmetics, female finery and jewellery, from quality establishments like Ball and Black's to the seedier stores on Water and Mercer Streets. They had their own cake and coffee houses where no male dare enter. And there were even gambling hells for ladies only. I mean society women, not cigar store tarts from below 14th Street. Where they bucked the tiger, that is, play for high stakes. Probably from the tiger sign used to denote a gambling house. And glued their menfolk's dividends at faro and billiards. And their husbands, sweethearts and paramours seemed to be all for it, and treated them with a regard and deference you'd never find in Europe. Why this should be, I don't know. New York men are certainly no more chivalrous than any other. It may be that women were scarce in colonial times and so grew to be particularly treasured. But my own theory is that the USA being all for progress and liberty, and New York in the vanguard of everything, its women have become emancipated sooner than their sisters elsewhere. They've usurped not a few masculine habits, too. Anywhere in the world you'll see roués with fast young women in tow. But only in New York was it common to see fashionable ladies of mature years settling restaurant bills and buying gifts for handsome young clerks. They picked them up over department store counters, I was told. And the New York female grows up at a startling rate. My first day there, I was astonished to see a party of society's schoolgirls, the kind whose parents live on Fifth Avenue and have the brats educated at Murray Hill, driving along in a basket wagon with a tiger on the step. None of them was above 12 years old, and all were got up like women of 20, even to the languid airs and gestures. So, that was my first impression of New York, gained in a few brief hours. Splendid women on the go, but nothing else out of the ordinary, for the town itself was a sort of larger Glasgow. There were no skyscrapers then, and chiefly remarkable for being paved, apparently, with peanut shells, which were sold by swarms of urchins and crackled underfoot wherever you turned, even in the lobby of the Astor House, to which we drove from the station. It was the place in New York just then. And large, even by American standards, a great barracks looking east across Broadway to the park, with a shaving mug and brush in each room. Talk about luxury, if you like. If my impressions are sketchy, I can only plead preoccupation. New York was where I was going to have to cut stick, not only eluding the cook class, but hiding out from them, preferably with a British consul who'd see to my passage home once he found out who I was. It was maddening and frightening to drive through crowded, bustling streets, to look about the busy lobby of a great hotel, to sit in the suite of rooms which had been reserved for us, and to know that I daren't stir a foot for fear of the unseen eyes that were following me everywhere. Soon after we arrived, when Joe had gone below stairs to chivy the porters about our bags, and Ernest and I were alone, I excused myself to visit the privy along the way. She didn't even turn her head as I slipped out into the passage, which seemed empty except for a couple of darkies clinging somnolently to their brooms. And then, at one end, was a nondescript white man who turned his back just a shade too hurriedly at the sight of me. I strode smartly the other way, and became aware of a chap lounging in an alcove ahead with a round hat tilted over his eyes. Of course, he may have been an innocent citizen, but I didn't know that. I stepped into the Thunder House, palpitating. It was empty so far as I could see, but it was 6 floors above ground, and by this time I was convinced that there was probably an armed dwarf crouching in the bloody cistern. Right, thinks I, we'll have to wait until dark. If I'm not a better night stalker than anything the cook class can show, it's a poor lookout. Meanwhile, we'll be a docile little prisoner and keep our eyes peeled. I headed back for our rooms and bore up sharp at the door, which was ajar, for voices were being raised within. Annette's and Joe's. Following her astonishing behavior the previous night when she'd crept into my arms blubbing like a baby, I'd looked to see a softening of her manner in the morning, but no such thing. The Annette who woke as we pulled into New York was her old shrewish self. When I referred to our tender interlude, she simply turned her back and ordered me out in her iciest tone so that she could get dressed. It was the same on the drive to the hotel with Joe on the box and at breakfast in the coffee room. She either ignored my remarks or replied in cold monosyllables, staring past me. And now, as I eavesdropped, she was in fine withering form with Joe, who was fighting a dogged rearguard action by the sound of it. I've got to wait for a reply at the Eastern Electric, he was protesting. Grixis can't get my message till afternoon. It could be evening before he telegraphs back. Might have to wait till morning even.
What of it? Do you think I intend to sit here waiting for you?
Might be best, ma'am. Can't leave Conway here on his lawn. One of us ought to be with him.
Don't be a fool. Of course I shan't leave him here. He'll come with me. Hermes's men will have him in view every moment. There are two of them, are there not?
Even so, ma'am. He'll be safest right here. He's a right slippy mean fellow and dangerous. I know it.
You know it. Oh, you know anything, you black dolt. You'll remember your place, which is to do my bidding. Do you hear? Now get to the telegraph office and don't return until you have Grixis's order to take him to Boston. I don't care if you have to wait until tomorrow or the day after.
He muttered something which I didn't hear, and she fairly hissed in fury.
Don't dare question me. Don't dare. Karma is my concern, not yours, you insolent awful. Do you hear? Answer me when I address you. Do you hear?
Yes, ma'am. His deep voice was shaking. Suppose now I get word from Grixis this afternoon where I find you.
You don't. Wait till I return. Now get out.
I met him in the doorway and murmured, Ah, Joe, how many free niggers get that kind of pleasuring, eh? And received a murderous glare before he strode off. Annette was putting on her bonnet before the mirror, but when I inquired where she was going, I was told curtly to hold my tongue and wait, which I did obediently, while she fussed with her appearance, referring every few minutes to the little gold watch which she kept in her reticule. She was paler than usual and twitchy as a nervous sepoy, drawing her gloves off and on and fiddling with her toilette. Something's up, thinks I. But after a while she seemed to settle, and it was a good half hour before she looked at her watch for the last time, stood up and informed me that we were going out.
I have business in town. You will come with me, and don't move a yard from me at any time, do you understand? Whatever I do, wherever I go, don't leave my side for a moment, and do not contradict anything you may hear me say. No. Do not ask questions.
She wrapped it all out like a tiny drill sergeant. Sturdy enough, but I guessed that she was up to high dough within and striving to hide it.
You have been watched, remember? Do not look around for anyone. They are there. Do nothing out of the usual, you hear? Your life depends upon it.
There was nothing she hadn't said in Washington, but the manner was new. She was scared, and I couldn't believe it was only on my account. I started to ask her what was amiss, but she bit my head off.
Be quiet, do as I say, no more. We're man and wife out in New York, so try to behave in a natural manner.
I was rich coming from her. She took a breath and handed me some change.
That is our streetcar fare. 3 cents apiece. Pay the conductor. Now give me your arm.
It was like walking with a badly wound-up clockwork doll as we descended to the street. But once we were out in the sunshine and the chattering Broadway crowd, she became easier. Possibly because I showed no tendency to cut and run or bawl for a copper. There's a great air of up and doing about New York. Everyone seems to be in a cheerful hurry, and even my apprehensions about the Ku Klux Bravos, who I was sure were dogging our steps, receded in that jolly bustle. We mounted one of the long cars which ran on rails on the broad thoroughfare. It was crowded to the doors, but half a dozen gallants begged Annette with much tipping of tiles and doing me the honor, Mary, to take their seats. And I'm bound to say she played up like the actress she was, smiling prettily as she accepted, and even referring demurely to
her husband,
to discourage one young blade who was being over-attentive. He gave me an apologetic grin and offered me a chew from his tobacco case, which I declined. Fortunately, the purse was too thick for him to start the relentless inquiry to which Yankees are wont to subject perfect strangers as to their origin, business, habits, and destination.
And after a couple of stages, Annette informed me that
this was our stop, Petra.
And we transferred to one of the omnibuses which ran on the cross streets.
Yeah,
I had my encounter with the Dollymops, who used me as a conductor. One of them exclaimed flirtatiously that I'd given her too much change, so I said gravely that in the presence of so much beauty I invariably became confused, and she should return any overpayment to my wife, who handled all my financial affairs.
This book is continued on cassette 5, so I'd won.